Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
The Sopranos is a television show. This bothers me about the image of New Jersey. The Sopranos is a television show. It's not reality. We run in the state of New Jersey a clean and honest casino industry. And we were very concerned about that when we brought gaming to Atlantic City in 1976, and the politicians and the proposers were careful with their legislation and their regulations, and we have a clean gaming industry. If we can run a clean gaming industry, we can certainly run a clean, ethical, efficient state public bank.
Hey, so much for stereotyping, okay? That was Dr. Deborah Feigert, defending the ability of the state of New Jersey to create a clean and responsible publicly owned state bank, which is now under consideration in the state legislature. It addresses one of the knee-jerk reactions about creating any state-owned entity, especially a bank, and we hear it all over the country. It seems like our fellow citizens think that they live in a banana republic sometimes, when they dismiss the idea that we can create and operate public banks with integrity and efficiency. Hi there, and welcome once again to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Ellen's co-host and chair emeritus of the Public Banking Institute, Walt McCree, discussing today a number of banking-related stories that you've been hearing about and putting them in context of other events that are shaping our world. As you may know, this program takes the view that money moves the world and that bankers move money. Therefore, we need to know and watch what goes on within those sectors and, of course, get under the reality of how this franchise of banking so determines almost everything we do. So on today's program, we're going to take a look at a new report issued by a noted economist who examines whether New Jersey would be better off with having a bank of its own and what some of those impacting metrics look like. And we'll pay a brief visit to the student debt phenomenon once again to illustrate how the federal government set the stage for increased college tuitions and expenses and how that has undermined the futures of so many students. But first, let's talk with Ellen about some of the other news stories pertaining to public banks and the monetary system that we all depend on.
So, Ellen, the big news, and we're considering it big, even though people will say, what's important about this, is that the second public bank in America has actually been realized. And for those of you who haven't gotten the word, it is the Territorial Bank of Samoa, American Samoa. And that is a big deal. But why is it a big deal? And by the way, in case you don't know, folks, American Samoa is a part of, a part of our government responsibilities, just as is Puerto Rico, which I think we can talk about in a minute. But Ellen, why is it so important that the American Samoas now have their public bank?
Mm-hmm. Well, at first, you could say, I mean, it's not exactly the second public bank. We have development banks. California has a development bank. But it is the first that we've gotten in this century. And it would be probably the third depository bank. So that's what we're talking about, is a bank that leverages capital, and takes deposits and does like other private banks do. So American Samoa, for 5 years, they've had no banks on the island. It was like totally, practically a cash-only economy. And still, it took the Federal Reserve 2 years to approve this public bank. And apparently the reason was that they didn't want to set a precedent. So that means they don't want us following like lemmings, which is exactly what we will be doing.
You're saying a precedent about establishing or supporting a public bank. That's the precedent.
Right. If they let one new public bank get established, right, then they'll have to let the others get established. And one interesting thing was that they didn't require FDIC insurance. So they're actually carving out an exception for a public bank, which is definitely something that we want. It's a barrier that we're always coming across. You have these rules that just really don't apply to a public bank, and yet that's the rule. And so you're going to have to change some laws to get around it. And one rule is for new banks, they're supposed to have FDIC insurance. But FDIC insurance only covers $250,000. And if your only depositor is a government, or virtually your only depositor, they will have much more than $250,000. I mean, look at California. We're talking about billions of dollars. So that insurance doesn't do you much good. And meanwhile, it puts you under the thumb of the FDIC, which is more or less controlled by Wall Street banks, since they're the big contributors. And it's an unnecessary expense you have to pay your share of the insurance. So that's one thing, and I don't know what they did about collateralization, but that's another thing we would like changed for a public bank, that right now in California, you have to collateralize your deposits at 110%. So that pretty much takes away any use for the deposits. If you have to buy, the collateral that they accept is very safe, low-paying type loans like federal securities. So if you have to buy low-paying federal securities to the extent of 110% of your deposits, you're not going to be able to use those deposits for your liquidity needs when you make loans. But again, it doesn't seem to make any sense to have to guarantee yourself, to have to collateralize your own money. You are in charge, and you can see, you, the state, can see what loans are being made, and you can make sure that they're safe loans. At least like one model we're looking at in California would be to turn the infrastructure bank into a depository bank. And the infrastructure bank, I mean, basically you would be lending to other local governments. So they are very safe bets.
Safe. And you said that there are other public banks that are you call them development banks. Are you talking about infrastructure banks, or the revolving fund type of bank?
Yeah, exactly. California is called the California Infrastructure and Development Bank. And the Puerto Rican bank it's called the Puerto Rican Development Bank, but it did take deposits. But it did a lot of other things that's not normal for a bank. I mean, they were inextricably linked to government, and they obviously made some bad decisions. They guaranteed private loans. You know, I saw an article for a golf course. They guaranteed this loan for a golf course to private investors. And, of course, the thing went south, and now the government's on the hook for that. Well, that's the very type of thing you don't want to do, and that's actually – virtually every state already has a provision that says, well, it's vague what they say, but these provisions go back to the mid-19th century when cities were guaranteeing the railroad loans because they wanted the railroads to come into their town. They thought it would be good for business. And then when the railroads went bankrupt, they were on the hook for these loans. So that's the type of thing you don't want to do, and that they should keep those provisions in the state laws, but they should clarify that that's what they're talking about. They're not talking about just making loans, because every state and every big city anyway makes loans. I mean, they have revolving funds that make loans.
Mm-hmm. The banking franchise is such a valuable asset, so strongly protected and defended by the private parties that control it now, 100 years after that period when every state had its own bank and many of them going bust. We're in kind of a new era. I suppose we could put the best construction on this by saying that the Fed took 2 years to handle the Samoa request because it wanted to be doubly sure that it wasn't going to be setting up another situation like this. But that's really not kind of what seems to shine through about that deal.
Actually, it was because they got a new regulator in. That's what happens when you change administration.
Interesting. Well, because, like, for example, in the postal banking discussion now, you know, the idea that the post office, which is already positioned and to pick up where it left off in the early 60s to help process payments and transfer money, and of course it's doing money orders, they're not talking about very complicated banking at all. But American Banker this week has a piece that just brings all kinds of sirens about postal banking should be a dead letter. That's the name of this editorial. Said, unlike fine wine, bad ideas do not get better with age. It's talking about New York Senator Gillibrand's Postal Banking Act, which would add a bank branch to every one of the 30,000 post offices. Now, we know that that is a terrific idea from the standpoint of trying to serve the 20 to 25% of our fellow citizens who do not have banking relationships that are now forced to go to payday lenders. This article goes on to say how how community banks are reaching into the market. No, they're really not. They're reaching 80% of the market. Well, that's it. The 20% that's not banked is not getting banked. But the whole scenario around protecting the sacredness of the banking facade that keeps the simple functionality of bankers and banking away from the public tool chest. It keeps that barrier between us so that only the bankers get to dispense the money when the people really need it. And that, of course, I think characterizes this public banking movement that we're doing here, trying to break through that franchise.
In 1910 or 12, before the Federal Reserve was set up, the U.S. postal banking system was set up. And it was by popular demand that people demanded that they have a safe place to put their money after this bank run in 1907 that, you know, was a major economic crisis. And so the government set that up, and immediately the American Bankers Association saw this as a threat, and they immediately went into action trying to stop it, and they fought the thing for the next 50 years until they finally got rid of it. And they did that by manipulating laws. But it was a very good thing, like particularly during the 1930s. It was a very safe place to have your money when all these other banks were going bankrupt.
It's very clear that, you know, people need money to function. It's the fluidity of our economy. But all over the world, down in South Africa this past week, the Economic Freedom Fighters made public its draft text for a banks amendment bill, which hopes to change the law there in South Africa to be able to license a full-fledged bank that is owned by a state institution. In other words, that there would be parity between the private bankers and the state institutions who would be entitled to create their own banks, which, of course, again, addresses this absolute need to get your hands on some cash to be able to support the things that an economy wants to do. I think you saw the commentary from San Francisco by a fellow who's actually a venture funds fellow who talked about how the effort in San Francisco to create a public bank is a really important one that the citizens need to stay in touch with, because previous such efforts have been diverted and diminished and abandoned for their greater public purposes because the city council or because the powers that be were not willing to relinquish that kind of control. And the point that he mentions, his name is Zach Townsend, and he says San Francisco has an obligation to manage public funds to prioritize environmental responsibility, fair labor practices, affordable housing, among other principles. And then he writes in this editorial, you, he says, as a San Franciscan, can influence the placement of billions of dollars. It's your money, he says. So just as I would recommend that you move your personal funds out of a big bank and find a local bank or credit union for your loans or bank accounts, so too should you advocate for the city to do the same thing. Contact the treasurer's office today. That's that populist dynamics, the flag that I think all of us have to pick up and insist that we get that kind of representation.
Right. And what we're looking for is basically a co-op where we, the people, get to share in the profits. I mean, it is our money, and it's our government, and we're paying taxes to this government. Where do we put our tax money? In Wall Street, where they get to use it for profligate purposes that we have no control over. In fact, you know, what has motivated the recent push for public banks is that first the move your money movement was individual, but now there's a divest movement to move your public monies out of Wells Fargo particularly. But then the question is, where do you put it? If not in Wells Fargo, do you put it in Chase, which also has a litany of lawsuits that they settled, but they settled for big money, so you have to suspect that they were guilty.
And as you pointed out, those very same banks are the ones that are running the Federal Reserve, that really have the most influence. Consequently, they're the ones who are sitting on applications for public banks, and actually all banks will always have to get over the hurdle of the big bank barrier. So opening up the banking franchise for the people, for public interest, and for our commonwealth.
In fact, the push is the other way. They're consolidating. They're getting bigger and bigger and eating up the little banks, forcing them out of business. I mean, I've seen people actually saying that that was the intent of some of these onerous regulations, was to force the little banks to sell out to the big banks because it's easier to regulate a few big banks than a bunch of little banks.
So we're right in the middle of it. And I have to say that the public banking initiative over the last 7 years has been a real catalyst for opening these discussions. The banking issues have been around for longer than that, but they certainly, 10 years ago, was a wake-up call for what happened in 2008 and what we saw then, in case lest anyone forget. When the big banks blew up, we bailed them out solely to protect their private franchise, for which we continue to pay. So the public banking movement is certainly expressive and derivative of that awareness that the big banks will not be stopped if we don't try to create some parity with them in terms of public interest over private profit.
And we have another crash that many people are predicting, and there's every reason to think it will happen because the Federal Reserve is doing exactly what they did in 2000. They lowered interest rates very low, actually, and maybe it's 1%, but anyway, they dropped them very low after the dot-com bust in order to supposedly stimulate the economy. And then when the economy overheated, as they say, when housing got too high, then they started raising rates. And when they got up to the prime rate, got up to 5.25%, then we had all these defaults, which led to the collapse. And they're doing the same thing all over again. They dropped interest rates all the way to zero, and now they're pushing them back up. So they're going to, we have student debt that's huge, auto debt, and credit card debt, and those things will start defaulting. And businesses, I guess 20% of businesses are expected to go bankrupt if they raise rate, the extent that they're talking about raising rates. So now you have the biggest banks are bigger than ever. The debt is higher than ever. The debt to GDP ratios of countries around the world are higher than ever. So it's expected to be a bigger crash. And this time, hopefully the government is not going to do another bailout. What they should do is nationalize those banks. We'll see.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll see what happens next.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thanks, Walt.
As you may know, New Jersey's new governor, Phil Murphy, has adopted creation of a publicly owned state bank as part of his state economic recovery plan. As a former Goldman Sachs banker himself, he clearly understands the power of having a banking franchise as a tool for better management and maximization of public dollars. Needless to say, most people in New Jersey are not yet familiar with what such a bank could do, or even if it's a good idea. Initial pushback from predictable sectors of the community has been seen, such as the Bankers Association, and also from hesitant citizens who see New Jersey as a home for criminal collusion and political corruption. So it was with great interest that a distinguished professor of economics at one of New Jersey's noted universities did a report on the state bank concept and how it would impact the state, whether it was a good idea and what benefits might be realized. That professor is our guest today on It's Our Money, Dr. Deborah Feigert of Stockton University, who produced her report for the Richard J. Hughes Center for Public Policy. I asked Dr. Feigert why she got interested in the public bank concept to begin with.
I used to live 10 blocks from the Atlantic City border, the city of Atlantic City, New Jersey. And Atlantic City is one of the places where economic development has been discussed and redevelopment since the dawn of the casino industry and even before that. And especially since what I call the year of the axe, 2009, after the Great Recession, when so many casinos closed in the city and so many employees lost their jobs. So I come to the public banking movement from a concern for urban and regional economic development.
And you opened your report with sharing the rather depressing report card that New Jersey, along with many other states in the country, received from the engineers of the nation, giving us D and D pluses. How does that feed into the public bank agenda and potential?
Well, a public bank would contribute enormously to funding economic development needs throughout America and in the state of New Jersey and in the city of Atlantic City, where Stockton is opening a new campus next fall. And it's very difficult to borrow money for infrastructure. And if states and municipalities could find a way to raise funds through a public bank and to borrow at lower interest rates than what typically Wall Street lends money for, I think that we could do a lot to generate state economic growth and municipal economic growth and redevelopment in the U.S. The state has, any state and any municipality has multiple bills it pays and multiple avenues of raising revenue and distributing bills to pay, and has to have accounts, financial accounts, to do this. And most of the money in the state of New Jersey is sitting in Wells Fargo. If it were sitting all of it or a good portion of it in a new state public bank, we could use a portion of, as long as we meet liquidity needs, we can use a portion of that money to lend out at low interest rates and use for state development.
So then instead of having the money sit in the large, typically global-sized banks, earning what, under 1%, I suppose, for their account returns interest, they could be in the market, is what you're saying, lent out at even low rates like 2%. That would be an advantage over what bond agencies are offering governments now, right?
And perhaps there could be some loans at 0% interest if the public bank were to get into the student loan business to invest in the human capital of our future state workforce. And private bank profits can go anywhere. They can go overseas. They can go to the Caribbean. They can go to the American South or American West. If we had a State Bank of New Jersey, we would be investing and reinvesting the money within the state. So any positive revenue that is not required at the end of a bank fiscal year or business year could go back, any surplus could go back to the state, or a portion of the surplus could go back to the state to help state revenue and state budgets and other state projects.
Yeah, it's an interesting dimension to this when you talked about the need to acquire capital as the essential for operating a government, and that we have to pay for that, but that this also is a revenue generator. And so that when the state makes loans, these loans, that would be the source for the income, new income that the state would have. Is that right?
That's right. Every time this public bank or any bank makes a loan, the amount of that loan is new cash and new income to somebody with an economic development idea or somebody building a house. And then that money is spent by those individuals or that business or that group. And then employees from that business go out and spend their income, and suppliers, new suppliers get income from that project. And there's backwards and forward linkages in the economy. And $1 can ripple to a multiple generation of dollars in income gains and economic development gains for a community.
So you're basically saying that we're getting access to new money that is not available currently in the marketplace for whatever reason, municipalities and states sometimes being borrowed out. And every new...
Can I say something about new money?
Sure.
It's important that you use this phrase, new money, because the reliable feasibility studies, the independent expert economists, business people, reliable feasibility studies for the efficacy and the impact of a public bank that have been done, one for the state of Vermont and one for the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico, they have shown that a public bank would indeed create new money. It's not a zero-sum game. We wouldn't be cannibalizing or taking money from other banking institutions in the area. It wouldn't be a net loss in terms of lending. It would be new money created and new loans created. And I think that is an important argument to deal with the fear that, oh, if you create a public bank, it's going to take away lending business from the private commercial banking industry.
And that is a pronounced fear, because even in the banking community, they think they're going to be losing business. But they wouldn't with this bank, would they? I mean, why is that? Why would they not be losing business?
Because it's new money created from state deposits. And it could be a portion of a state deposit, or it could be all of the state deposits eventually if you phase it in. The state of New Jersey and its higher education institutions and its economic development agencies and its casino control commission, they all have money deposited somewhere. And all we're talking about is moving some of the deposits to a new state bank that could lend it out at lower interest rates. And money through a multiplier creates money. So as long as the state bank lends, and as long as private commercial banks lend, money is created. It is an economic boom multiplied effect.
Yeah, in your report you have several multipliers that you referred to, and can you walk us through a few of those now? For you talk about those new dollars that you just mentioned were referenced in your report in several different ways. For every $1 million of new credit or lending, we have an increase in jobs and in value to GSP. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that, and new state output. So new jobs, new value added, new state output. You gave a couple of examples of Vermont and Santa Fe. What are those metrics representing?
Well, when we lend money in any economy, that money is put to use, and suppliers receive money, businesses receive money, employees are paid, and they spend money in the community. They go grocery shopping, they do their laundry, they put their children in childcare, and those businesses get new money. So $1 can have a multiplied effect. And that's what I estimated with very reliable multipliers, which we can chat about, produced by the federal government, Bureau of Economic Analysis, that if, let's say, we had $100 million of new lending for a State Bank of New Jersey, not an unreasonable estimate given the size of the state budget,
right?
And that's just the state executive and its spending of about $37 billion a year. If we had $100 million of new lending, we would double that in terms of the effect on state gross state product, GSP, which is the state equivalent to GDP. So it would be almost $200 million added to state gross state product. Wow. We could create almost 1,000 jobs, permanent jobs, with $100 million in new lending. And, you know, these are not, this is not a rosy scenario. This is very reliable multipliers that come from the U.S. Department of Commerce Bureau of Economic Analysis, urban and regional planners, economic development consultants use these multipliers to study the impact of doing anything all across America. Opening a new business, supporting a museum, building a new library, enlarging a university, putting up a bridge, enlarging the waterways, dredging the waterways. This is the same organization, federal organization, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, that gives us these multipliers. This is the same organization that gives us our gross domestic product numbers in a very painstakingly way. They know more about economic development than anyone.
So you're saying for every $100 million, we could about double the dollar output because of the impact on the state generally. Very interesting. Well, people will say this is New Jersey that is not North Dakota, as if that proves much of anything other than they're different economies. But it seems to me that North Dakota, which has had this public bank in place for just about 100 years, has done exceedingly well. It can't be compared with anything other state in the nation in terms of its efficiencies. But the principles of the public bank operate regardless of the simplicity of their economy. So they have agriculture and they have fossil fuel income, but they have a small population. Is it true, in your view, that those differences would not impact negatively New Jersey's outcome, or would we be better off, do you think?
I think, if anything, New Jersey would even have more of an economic impact. Think of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. Each state has a specialty. New Jersey has pharmaceuticals and gaming and finance, as well as agriculture and wineries. Every state has something that they specialize in that they're good at. Every state suffers the ups and downs of the economy, recessions, as well as boom times. So to put all the eggs in the oil basket and the agricultural basket in South Dakota, if anything, a more diverse state would see greater benefits for a public bank, because we could develop all aspects of the state, the industries we're strong in, and perhaps new industries and new ideas to help state economic development.
One of the aspects of this bank franchising, this unique opportunity to create new money, as you said, is for us to be able to actually leverage 10 times the amount of capital, which is the undisturbed liquid nest egg of the bank, 10 times that. So we'd actually have a lot more money working into the state economy than we would without this.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
It almost seems like it's irresponsible not to have our own bank since we're spending so much.
If you could have a public sector state or city or township or municipality create so much economic development by just using some funds from their own treasury, and you could borrow at a lower interest rate and have that loan amortized so that you would pay much less over the life of the loan, why wouldn't you do it? It's a no-brainer.
It is a no-brainer. It's really interesting. Well, the pushback is, of course, that you're going to undermine the banking industry, and I think that somebody's going to get hurt, somebody's ox is going to get gored, at least in their view, as if it were a zero-sum game. And I think what you're saying is that, no, it's not that. We're actually expanding the pie, as George Bush might say.
Yes, we are expanding the pie. Anytime somebody issues a loan, we are expanding the economy. We are creating economic growth. Anytime somebody hires an employee, we're expanding the economy, we're generating economic growth. So the estimates that we talked about, the multiplier effect with my number crunching in the report, that is an underestimate of the effect on the state because it does not include the direct effect of the bank opening up in a city or cities and hiring its own employees who are civil servants, according to the bill, working through the state legislature. So it's really a lowball estimate because there's more direct impact that the state bank would have in addition to the numbers we talked about.
Do you have a sense of what a normal sort of an estimation of what this bank could initially produce?
I don't right now, but this is exactly why I call for the governor, Phil Murphy, to appoint a commission of independent experts knowledgeable about public banking to do a feasibility study where they can generate some possible scenarios of how large the initial deposits should be, how many employees are required to run the bank, develop a possible business plan, and then we could generate that multiplier effect. But I think the governor needs to do two things. One is get an independent, high-quality economic feasibility study that has those scenarios, possible scenarios of how much money should be put to initially capitalize the bank, and then how much over time to phase in a move from private commercial banking to state banking for all of our state agencies. And then I think the governor should also, the second policy I'm calling for is for the governor to work with the state treasurer and the commissioner of banking and insurance on a possible business plan for this new state bank of New Jersey so that the board, when we have the bank, the newly appointed board can get to work faster on revising the business plan and opening the doors of the bank.
What about risk? That's what a banker's job is, managing risk. How do you see that coming into play here?
I think the board will have a bunch of experienced people on it from the credit union sector and the private banking sector and from academe and from government. And I think it's their job to manage risk as if it were any financial institution in the United States. And the legislation calls for that. The legislation proposed calls for bank examinations and independent audits. And I feel safe with the board running the place that it will be well run. It will have a mission that's updated and it will have people minding the books and minding the shop and able to make adjustments from quarter to quarter, year to year.
You're seeing this as a pretty transparent sort of a public institution, I gather. So the people would be able to see what the bank is up to and who's involved, perhaps.
In any public sector institution in the state, there is tremendous transparency. Mm-hmm. For things other than executive session, you can see the minutes of meetings. Wow. People's, if you're a state employee, your salary is public to members and citizens of the state. There is so much transparency, and as civil servants, there's ethics forms and ethics policies and things we must do yearly to be completely transparent to the voters who are paying our salaries.
And of course, that speaks to the broad concern that just like we're not North Dakota, New Jersey has this reputation for corruption. Everybody's afraid, what, are you going to give the politicians a bank? You're nuts. You know, that sort of thing. But you're
speaking. Can I say something?
Oh, please.
The Sopranos is a television show. This bothers me about the image of New Jersey. The Sopranos is a television show.
Yeah.
It's not reality.
You know, I'm so glad you said it that way.
Let me say one other thing. We run in the state of New Jersey a clean and honest casino industry, gaming industry. And we were very concerned about that when we brought gaming to Atlantic City in 1976, and the politicians and the proposers were careful with their legislation and their regulations, and we have a clean gaming industry. If we can run a clean gaming industry, we can certainly run a clean, ethical, efficient state public bank.
That's nicely said, and I appreciate your making that point, because I do think that when we're talking about the people's money, this is our treasure, having a high integrity legacy institution around our money could be an enormous boon for where New Jersey needs to go. Where we are now, of course, the headlines are filled with our economic woes and the challenges, inability to do the things we need to. You see this as a key component to getting out of this hole?
Getting out of the shortage of funds for public infrastructure, the dearth of funds that municipalities have had since we've been cutting government since the 1980s. I see this as a new light, new energy, a new way to go to rebuild cities and towns and states all across the United States.
And how do you see the public will as defined by the many stakeholders at the citizen level, whether they're students or work environment people or unions and, you know, the grassroots? How does this bank serve their interest?
Well, anybody that is a beneficiary of a direct loan or an indirect multiplied effect whose job has been created by somebody lending money from the public bank, or whose business has received money locally because of a construction project funded by the public bank, any construction project would be good news to the AFL-CIO. We are public infrastructure. You started off by saying in New Jersey, our average score is D+ for public infrastructure. So if we could reinvest in our communities from north to south, so many state citizens would benefit.
You don't see this bank as a retail organization where people would go in and get a mortgage or a car loan. That's how you're envisioning it. It's just a partnership bank, a banker's bank, as it were.
Correct.
Yeah.
It is a state banker's bank. And in the proposed legislation, it also says that this new State Bank of New Jersey can go into partnership with private commercial banks on any project. Mm-hmm. So this is why it's not a zero-sum game. It's good for the citizens of New Jersey who will benefit from a state bank giving out loans. It could also be good for the banking industry because it's new money being lent.
And certainly the metrics in North Dakota indicate the huge impact, positive impact it's had on the commercial banks, on the community banks and the credit unions. Well, Deb, thank you very much for this time. Congratulations on this really pivotal report. You're the first out of the gate with an assessment of what the State Bank of New Jersey could be. I must say you've excited us with this prospect, and it'll be interesting to see what happens next. If the people stand with this, as I trust they will, we might just have be the first one in the country to have the next public bank in our first in 100 years in the United
New
States.
New Jersey could be a very good model, and I would encourage your listeners and your viewers to check out my economic impact study for the State Bank of New Jersey, available for download from the William J. Hughes Center for Public Policy at Stockton University.
Thank you so much, Dr. Feigert. It's been good to have you.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Deborah Feigert, Distinguished Professor of Economics at Stockton University in New Jersey, discussing her recent report examining the prospects of a State Bank of New Jersey. Again, you can find a copy of that recent report at stockton.edu/Hughes-Center under Research Publications. In our continuing series of editorials, looking behind the curtain of monetary control, Bob Bowes takes another look at the historical context of the current political and monetary stage and describes the real players on the stage of global finance and politics as we take another peek behind the curtain.
In addition to the use of armaments in propaganda, those who control money creation employ various forms of currency and value to destroy their enemies. These are tried and true tactics. For example, take the actions of the British bankers when the American colonists, via the Continental Congress, issued their own scrip, the Continental, to pay for General George Washington's troops and supplies. The British bankers counterfeited the Continental and flooded the American money supply with this faux currency, drastically devaluing the Continental. 122 years later, in 1913, after the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel finally succeeded in establishing what they hoped to be a permanent private central bank of the United States, the so-called Federal Reserve System, the use of counterfeiting and its twin bludgeon, speculation, became constant strategies for the U.S. government as the leading proxy for this criminal crime syndicate. In addition to counterfeiting and speculating in national currencies as a form of warfare, the cartel uses other forms of value, such as oil and gold, to accomplish the same ends. While the cartel's U.S. proxy holds the levers of the Fed, which issues the currency for the world's largest economy, that also serves as the world reserve currency, still the medium for 80% of global transactions, and the Pentagon, which oversees the cartel's military materiel production, the cartel's Saudi Arabian proxy is the world's largest oil producer. For example, when the cartel decided that the Saudis would flood the oil market by overproducing and distributing oil at low prices, the strategy was actually an attack on Russia, Venezuela, and Iran, which resulted in a devaluation of their currencies and a precipitous drop in their national incomes from oil, thus disturbing their balance of payments as well. In addition to paper currency and oil, gold is the other major role player in currency wars. Like oil, the theft of gold from target nations is standard operating procedure. Over the centuries, the cartel's vast accumulation of this precious metal has made it an effective and convenient store of value. This means, as the cartel steals value from nations, businesses, and individuals, that it has a third commodity to manipulate and leverage, along with its rigging of capital and oil markets, in order to achieve its iniquitous and ignominious plans. This brings us to the cartel's current use of all these techniques against Iran, which is one of only five countries that controls its own central bank and currency. It also exports a considerable amount of oil and presumably has a healthy amount of gold in its coffers. Both National Security Head John Bolton and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have declared that regime change is the object of the cartel's U.S. proxy. Everything that the cartel is currently throwing at Iran via its proxy governments, the U.S., U.K., France, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, qualifies as grounds of war. The most recent round of attacks began with the executive puppet, POTUS, offhandedly saying that he was not inclined to renew the agreement in place that was brokered to prohibit any Iranian nuclear enrichment program. At the same time, banks in the UAE and Saudi Arabia are deliberately delaying the processing of Iran's oil payments, which have risen significantly since the partial lifting of sanctions. As a result, the value of Iran's currency has fallen to its lowest since the 1979 Khomeini Revolution, inducing panic as Iranians dump rials in a desperate bid to get dollars. European diplomats have told Reuters off the record that even if Germany, France, and UK decided to remain in the agreement, Western companies would withdraw from Iran because of the threat of U.S. sanctions. While the public is sold this ruthlessness under the Red Party marketing brand, it is a continuation of the same strategy that the cartel implemented under the Obama administration and many predecessors going back at least 70 years. If this drift continues, we should expect that on May 12th, the cartel's U.S. proxy will use its unstable actor puppet, POTUS, to withdraw from the nuclear agreement under some false premise to further turn the screws. For our complete article on currency wars, see our site, coloradopublicbanking.blogspot.com. Look for our comprehensive analysis of planetary issues and strategies in our upcoming book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation. Pulling back the curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
We've discussed a number of real-world dramas unfolding around us economically, all of them driven by a matrix of debt issuance from profiteering of many sorts. While our cultural economy considers that merely to be the essence of capitalist interests, the cost of our accepting it without examination includes our acceptance of the struggles and deprivations that are sustained in people's lives, which are driven to satisfy those debt obligations, sometimes at all costs. The notion of scarcity prevails, as simply the way it is. Another foundational element of human community that has learned to adopt this matrix is in higher education, where tuitions and student debt have skyrocketed. Ellen had a recent conversation with a professor and author who is on the front lines of student debt, both in his own life and with the national organization called Strike Debt.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Nicholas Hartlip, who is an assistant professor of urban education at Metropolitan State University in Minnesota and co-edited an award-winning book titled The Neoliberal Agenda and the Student Debt Crisis in U.S. Higher Education, a quite provocative title.
I've come to research this problem of neoliberal capitalism and student debt. I believe that there's a lot of problems why students continue to graduate with larger and larger amounts of debt. Among many reasons is states not actually supporting higher education. And it is a risky act nowadays to actually go to college, because if you do graduate and you do have debt, you're beholden to the labor economy. And so depending on, you know, how much debt, depending on how much you gain, that is a risky endeavor.
Can you define the neoliberal agenda? Neoliberal is a sort of a contradiction in terms. It sounds like, oh, the new liberal, which is the opposite of conservative, but it's actually very conservative. In other words, it's liberalizing the laws, meaning opening up the laws, meaning basically getting rid of the laws, getting rid of government, and letting the market decide, or letting market forces decide. But it's basically all about privatization, right?
Yeah. So in the book, we kind of make a distinction that the current higher education system is neoliberal. And you're right, Ellen, that it's more towards a privatization. It's more towards using the market to guide careers and actions within higher education. And so we make the distinction between the current form, neoliberal education, and then we distinguish that from potentially a post-neoliberal moment. And so it might look like a time when higher education is free, when you don't have to incur student loans. And we also examine potential alternatives to the current status, which we find sorely wanting. In other words, it's difficult to finance higher education within this neoliberal regime, because what you're doing is you're just changing the chairs on the Titanic and it's sinking.
I saw you had a chapter on monetary reform. I mean, that's my whole thing, is that we really have to change the money system if we want to fix these problems. We have a money system that's geared toward, I guess, what you could call neoliberal. So how is it that we got here? I mean, tuition was free when I went to school. I went to Berkeley, and it was free. And I went to law school at something like $500 a semester. I mean, it was quite cheap at UCLA. So the system has obviously changed, and I think it was with President Johnson's Great Society that they started making these student loans supposedly to help the poor. And I mean, no doubt it was well intended, but something went wrong between there and here. They made loans available, but they didn't put a cap on tuition, so then the schools could just raise their rates to what the market would bear. That's it. You've got the problem of, on the one hand, you have government pumping money into something, but not as money, pumping it in as debt. And then you allow capitalism to run riot on the other side, where they can capitalize on this money that's coming from the government. So,
well, I think you stated it nicely.
It definitely is just a debt trap. I tend to think that they, whoever they is, intentionally want students to be enslaved by debt. So in my day, in the 60s, the students who were there for free were out in the streets campaigning against the Vietnam War. Students were, you know, have always been a force to be reckoned with. They're the ones out there trying to change things. But if you're really struggling just to make ends meet, you don't have time for any of that. I think that's the real reason people are opposed to a universal basic income, too, is that they think it's good for people to be trapped in debt so that they'll work harder.
I would agree with you. I think that, you know, that is the goal. I mean, I think they do want people to have debt, and because they're constantly having to pay it. But one other related thing is, for higher ed, there are so many universities that are pumping out terminal degrees each year, PhDs. Well, there are only so many faculty positions. Tenure track, rather. So there's a more graduates than there are positions. And there, again, causes intense competition for these limited jobs. The rest, right, they'll have to do something else to make ends meet. But it is fascinating, debt and its relationship with our economy and jobs.
I've been speaking with Nicholas Hartlep, Assistant Professor of Urban Education at Metropolitan State University in Minnesota and the co-editor of The Neoliberal Agenda and the Student Debt Crisis in U.S. Higher Education.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!